We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished players, authors, content creators, and improvers about their lives, their careers, and about ways that you might be able to improve your own chess game. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined by a return guest this week, although, again, it's been 5 years since I've talked with him. He is a beloved commentator, a YouTube creator, a Twitch streamer, an author, and a prolific Chessable course creator, often collaborating with IM Richard Palliser. He's worked on the Iron English, Grandmaster Gambits, the Art of Attack in Chess, and I believe most recently, the British Grand Prix Sicilian. He's known to many, of course, as the Ginger GM. He recently launched a site called GChess that we'll be discussing. And we're excited to welcome him back to the show. Simon Williams, how are you, sir?
Hi, Ben. I'm very good, thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on your extremely popular chess podcast. So thank you for having me.
Thank you. Yeah, we've come a long way since we chatted in January and in January of 2017, both of us, hopefully.
Definitely. Yeah. It's nice. It's been it's always interesting in the chess world, journeys that people make, right?
So, yeah, it is. I mean, it's a game of survival. Don't get checkmated and hope for the best. And I kind of wanted to pick it up by kind of talking about some of our shared experience, which of course we talked about in length. In our first interview, we met at the Reykjavik Open in what I believe was 2006. And we don't need to rehash that, but I did see that you're going to the Reykjavik Open. You tweeted that you'll be playing in this, of course, landmark tournament in Iceland from April 6th to April 12th. So I thought that would be a good opportunity to talk about your game a little bit, Simon, because obviously you're making so much content for your loyal audience and putting out so much great stuff. But every once in a while, you like to dust off the chess pieces. So how does a decision like that come to be? And then dare I ask, Simon, like, if anything goes into preparation and stuff like that when you decide you're going to compete?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I at the end of the day, I'm a chess player. That's what I started out being, playing chess, love playing chess. And that's what I love doing. I love playing chess, you know, competing in tournaments, playing other people. And, you know, so it's lovely to be have the opportunity to still do that. Not as easy as maybe it used to be because, you know, you get older, things get tougher and more young people come along. But I love the competition. I love the aspect of, you know, just fighting over the board at a longer time control as well. We all play so much blitz chess now. It's nice to actually have one game a day or two games a day where you can get really absorbed in the process or you know, how the game works. And Reykjavik seemed like a great place to play. I love Reykjavik. I'd highly recommend it to anyone out there who wants to play a tournament. Doesn't matter what strength you are, just, you know, give it a go. Don't be scared. It's got a very wide range, so even if you're low rated, you can play. And even if you score zero, it really doesn't matter. That I scored zero all the time when I started playing. Still do, hopefully not in Reykjavik, but but it's great. I mean, it's obviously a little bit pricey in Iceland, but it's beautiful. To, you know, beautiful scenery, lovely place. The venue is the Harper Concert Hall, overlooking the harbour, and it's beautiful. You can play a game of chess and look out to see, if you're lucky, see the Northern Lights, and an amazing venue, and also just the Icelandic people and, you know, Scandinavian people in general. I just have an affinity for. I they've always been very friendly towards me. Nothing to do with my ginger beard, probably. so maybe, you know, but it, you know, I can't say enough good things about it. So I'm very much looking forward to going back and playing. I mean, your comment about, you know, my preparation and stuff, it certainly gets a bit harder. I mean, I don't think I've really ever planned much in my life. You sort of fall into things. And when we met, it was similar. I don't think any of us really knew what we were doing even then. And
of course, you know, not.
We were just getting on with life, you know. And, yeah. You know, I, like I say, I was played and taught. Then, you know, media came along and I started getting involved with, you know, videos and streaming and commentary and everything I'm doing now. And, you know, to be honest, it paid well, and it was something I really enjoyed doing. And it was also, I thought, the best way for me to pass on my knowledge and my love of the game to other people, which I think is important to share that. So that's kind of taken over as, you know, the way that pays my rent and what I like doing it. But playing chess is my love. That's what I like to do. Will I have time to do any preparation? Well, it's, you know, all the courses I create help because I pretty much play everything that I've created, you know, at times and places. But for a big tournament like this, I would like to think I'll have time to prepare an opening, a specific opening that will take my opponents by surprise. And I'm sort of aiming to do an hour a day, you know, for at least a couple of weeks. Whether that will happen or not, I'll tell you right after Reykjavik. So
or don't tell us.
Yeah, you'll probably find out by the way I play.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so. It's, yeah. Well, I mean, like you say, it's fun. It's fun that you're getting back out there, and your enthusiasm for chess is, I think, part of the reason you found such a big audience. You can't fake that, and you're between your chess style and all the original openings that you find, and your obvious enthusiasm for chess. It's no surprise to me that you've had the success you've had, and hearing you talk about how at the end of the day you're a chess player does take me back to when we met in 2006, because it seems like it was such a different world then. I mean, the chess internet was tiny, you know, and if you were out there competing, it was even more so than now. I feel like it had to be for the love of the game. And at that time you were an IM, strong IM, you know, working on the GM title, but you hadn't earned it yet. And I was, you know, we've been talking a lot about titles here on the podcast lately. Last year, when I interviewed Ben Feingold, he broke down his chase for the GM title, which it turned out wasn't really a chase. He just said he just loved chess and played and got good enough and what earned the title. But of course, I've interviewed Lawrence Trent and Sean Nagel, and more recently some masters trying to earn the IM title. But I'm curious, Simon, how much design went into your earning the GM title, which, based on what you've said about how you plan your life, I have an inkling, but let's kick it over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know if I've really planned anything ever, which is, you know, I don't, I mean, you have goals in life, and it's good to try to have healthy goals. But, you know, you should do the things you enjoy doing in life. That's obviously clear. And I've been very lucky to enjoy, you know, being able to enjoy chess and always being able to enjoy playing. Obviously, the painful losses are separate to that. But, I mean, for me, I suppose my journey was my dad played a lot. I got quite strong when I was young, became an international master. I can't even remember the age, probably around 16, 17, something like that. I went to university, went a bit astray, shall we say. We won't go into too many details there. But around that period of early 20s, I spent then 5 years sort of finishing off university, a three-year course down in Brighton area. Got delayed. I worked in a call center for a year.
Oh, wow.
On minimum wage.
Wow. So did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did a whole year. It was horrible. Phoning up people, you know, trying to get them subscribed to a magazine. After that, after university in Brighton, I got into teaching at schools, which was a bit more stable income. But always played. I always played. So if I, the good thing about when I was an international master, even though I had no money, you normally get your, help with your expenses. So I had the opportunity to go to Iceland, and I wouldn't have to pay for it myself, which really helped me to go and play and enjoy that experience. And really around my 20s, I was able to play a bit more. And I just really tried to play as many competitions where the Grandmaster title was available. And it just came, really. I mean, I got a couple of norms in a couple of tournaments back to back. I think it was the Isle of Man competition, a very strong one, or maybe I can't even remember now, Ben. But it came in that period of just playing a lot, enjoy playing, and enjoy studying the game. And what I found, and of course it was a different world, as you mentioned, it was the thing that really helped me was preparation at tournaments. So this is one thing that people at home maybe have not experienced. And if you go to a tournament like Reykjavik or any of these international tournaments, the game generally starts, I don't know, like they say 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. And the routine will be, you can do 2-3 hours preparation in the morning for your opponent, especially nowadays with how strong computers are. And doing that on a regular basis, over the period of a year or two, which I know not everyone's able to do, but just preparing for your opponent and then going into the battle and trying to use those openings really helped me. Even if I didn't get the opening in the game, that information would be stored there for something else. And I build this up, this information up on, save it and hopefully store it inside my mind. But as you say, Ben, it was a complete different world. Why didn't someone tell me about Bitcoin in 2006 or something?
That would have been nice.
Forget about the chess. just tell me about Bitcoin and then I will, I won't do any coaching then. So what year did Bitcoin come out? Round, I don't know, or maybe it's a bit too young, is it?
I'm not a big expert, but yeah, sure. I think it was a handful of years later, but still,
But it was crazy. I mean, the preparation was actually, funnily enough, still similar, that you go there with your laptop, you'd search for your opponent, you prepare for your opponent. Preparation away from the tournament is now changed a lot with Chessable and other great things. But the whole media thing, it just wasn't there. You couldn't, imagine that. You couldn't watch chess online. And you can watch so much online now. It's everywhere. There's tournaments. I mean, even since I've been streaming, I go on to Twitch, and there's now 40 people streaming chess. It's crazy.
And so many of them are amazing. You just can't watch it all. It's so many great presenters. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's brilliant. I mean, I think we're really spoiled now. I mean, you've got presenters for everyone. I mean, understandably, not everyone will enjoy my presentation. That's very understandable. But which is good. But then if you don't like my presentation, there's someone else who does the kind of presentation you do like, and vice versa. So whatever kind of commentary you like, it's basically out there nowadays, which is brilliant as a chess player.
Yeah, I feel the same way about 90 minutes of audio only chess talk. I understand it's not for everyone. That's okay, as long as people are listening, I'm happy to do it. Yeah. But it sounds like you got the title, Simon, mainly similar to what Ben Feingold said. I mean,
me and Ben are brothers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know you guys have had some rivalries or faux rivalries online. It's never clear, never clear when the line has been crossed. But I know that you guys, I'd say you have some fans in common, most likely. But in any event, would you say, so I know you were playing a lot of events then, you were an active player, but were you like specifically training for the GM title, or was it just like you were just so in chess and you figured it would come?
Well, I definitely wanted to become Grandmaster. I mean, when I say I didn't really knew where I was going or whatnot, I think having goals, having aims is very important. And as I got the International Master title quite young, the Grandmaster title was, you know, the ultimate aim, and working towards that and trying to get that certainly was a big motivation. You know, without that, maybe I would have lost a bit of interest, but you know, you want to achieve that and have that title for life. And you know, by working towards that, that certainly helped me, kept me motivated, I'd say, in a more way. And I suppose for anyone else watching, maybe it is a great idea to have some idea in mind of what you're trying to achieve when you're doing chess. But I would also like to warn people not to get too carried away with ELO and things like this. There's so many people who like, I need to get to this ELO, I need to do this. You're going to have really bad runs. And I often found when I had dumps in ELO rating was actually when I felt I was playing best, and it was just experimenting, trying out new styles. And you're bound to dip in strength when you experiment, but in the long run, it's a very healthy process to do. So don't get too worried if things go down in the short term. They should improve in the long term, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you made it, because Ginger IM just doesn't sound as good.
No, that's right. Yeah. That's right. I had to keep the branding going.
Exactly. So, obviously you were playing a ton, and obviously you mentioned you got the IM title quite young. So again, you were kind of knocking on the door anyway, but at that time, aside from playing a ton and going over the games, was there any sort of training you were doing, Simon?
Well, I never had a coach as such. Well, my dad was a strong player, so he taught me the openings I still really play now. The one thing I would do, and I think, you know, the bit of advice I give, maybe it's changed a bit now, but I think I would have quite a short number of openings that I play. I think that has changed now because preparation is more important, but I don't think you can learn all openings under the sun. And I also feel, don't get too carried away with openings. You know, it's like, it's so easy to obsess over them, and they're important, but they're really important to give you positions that you enjoy playing. So that even if they're supposed to be a bit dubious, it really doesn't matter. Just get in positions you enjoy playing. And the more you enjoy the game, the more you're going to get better in the middle game and ending. So having an idea of what openings I wanted to play was certainly there. That was important. I would try to look at tactics a bit, but it was really anything I did with chess was stuff I enjoyed. And I think that's the key thing. Just do things you enjoy. Don't force yourself. If you think, oh, I need to work at endings, but you hate working at endings, don't do it. It's as simple as that, because you're not going to learn anything. As long as you do things you enjoy, you're just going to get better. But tactics, doing tactic puzzles, I found very useful as well. Obviously, in my days, there were only books that you could do tactics from. It wasn't like all the apps you can get. But I found that extremely, extremely useful as well. So tactics, openings, not getting too despondent when things didn't go my way. And obviously, learning from the game, as I was playing so much, you lose a game, don't lose the same way twice. This is so important. This is probably the most important thing. You know, like it's that saying, if you make a mistake in life, it's fine. You can be fooled once, but you shouldn't be fooled twice, because then you are a fool. So, you know, I probably still do that nowadays, I'll be honest, but I try not to.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I try not to. So if you do lose a bad game or something goes wrong, why? And, you know, just work on that and you will improve.
Yeah, good advice. And hearing you discuss your sort of longtime affinity with certain openings, actually, we have a very related question from a Patreon supporter of the pod, Bruno Johnson. So Bruno writes in and he says he ended up picking the Iron English and Classical Dutch as his main openings, mainly to go in more unknown territories, but also because if he has to learn some openings, might as well have some fun with the Ginger GM. So he'd like to know how you came to pick those openings in particular when you were not old enough to grow your trademark beard. So were those also passed on from your dad, Simon?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's as simple as that. My dad played the Botvinnik Iron English and the Classical Dutch. And that was it. You know, yeah. It's as simple as that. He, you know, funnily enough, though, if you think about where he learned them from, you know, it's the Dutch is considered quite dubious by a number of people now, and the English people don't like playing because they consider it boring. But he actually picked these openings up from the likes of Botvinnik, who played the Dutch, the classical Dutch, Mikhail Tal, Aliekhine, and the English as well. So he got them from a very good basis, and that's how I learned them. I just picked them up from my dad and developed them as much as I could. I found them interesting, and I tried to bring some of my own ideas into the openings as I developed and you know, as a chess player.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, obviously, I've been aware of your chess since we met in 2006, and it was very clear, like just seeing you go over games and you know do a postmortem over a pint or whatever it may be, that you have this attacking style. So I remember being surprised that you were an English player, because that's not what I associated it with.
Yeah, the English might be a bit strange. I mean, I have sort of moved on. I moved on sort of on the way, you know, to becoming a grandmaster. I sort of adapted my English to D4 and playing more queen's pawn openings, and that helped me a lot. But I still play the English a lot. And again, I think someone, it was an international master from England, gave me a great bit of advice. And he said, when I was young, and he played the English, and he said, you don't need to force tactics. Don't try and force, you know, you don't need to go always for your opponent's king. Tactics occur in chess with any opening. It doesn't matter what you play. The idea that some openings are really boring, even though I mentioned that earlier, it's kind of a bit of a fallacy. You're going to always get tactics and interesting positions no matter what you play. And I really think the English is actually extremely flexible opening, and in some ways more interesting than E4, E5. It's top level. You look at the amount of Berlin draws that happen. You can't get this in the English. You can't. There's no easy way to take the sting out of getting a very simplified position. So I think it's a very good opening, the English, and a very good positional opening to give you great foundations moving forwards. I mean, I think for me as an attacking player, playing something like that forced me to learn to play positionally. So it maybe helped my overall game even.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I agree. And like you say, and this, you know, some of the, I think it was Peter Hein Nielsen, but someone in discussing the world championship said, like, E4 is so concrete now that often it's E4 that can lead to the more drawish games. You know, you've got the Petrov and the Berlin to navigate. So that alone, not to mention the Marshall, which even though Black, if it goes into the main line, is sacrificing a pawn, a lot of the games have a tendency to fizzle out, at least at the top level. So yeah, plenty of fertile ground in what starts out as quieter openings. Now, you mentioned your dad's being sort of a student of Botvinnik and Aliekhine, and as you mentioned in our prior interview, your dad, I believe, was like 2100 FIDE player, just to give listeners context. Cody Noble wrote in to ask if you have a favorite historical player and why they're your favorite.
I think it's always been the same. It's been a towel. Probably as I've mentioned many times before, towel was just base. Sorry, that's just me opening a can there. Sorry,
nice.
Sorry, not a can of beer, a can of just in case people are wondering. But it was it was just towel, because he was just the way he played chess was just from another planet. It didn't even have a lot of logic to it. Sometimes it was alien like. And watching his unsound sacrifices were mesmerizing. And I don't think there'd be anyone, there was not really anyone like Tao, and I don't think there'd be anyone like him in the future even. He's just one of a kind and a joy to watch. So, yeah, definitely Tao.
Yeah, I can't remember. I probably have heard you say it, but I was sure that was your answer.
A safe bet, yeah.
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 And Cody Noble had one other question, which is, what is the most interesting place you've played a tournament and what made it unique?
Okay, wow, that's quite interesting. Reykjavik, as we mentioned, it is certainly one of the most interesting places I've played. Probably, though, India. I've only been to India once, and I went to play the under-21 World Championships, representing England at the time. I actually played Lauren Fresnay in that tournament, uh-huh. Which is quite funny. Stonewall Dutch, I remember it. And I found India just completely again, the word alien, it was sort of completely not what you could imagine it to be in many respects. And that was a real amazing experience. So India was certainly somewhere. It was right on the south of India and Kerala, a real eye-opening place to play. But yeah, I mean, the good thing about being a chess player, you know, is I've had the opportunity to see many places I'd never, ever get the chance to see. So I've been very lucky traveling and visiting some great places and some horrible places as well.
Yeah, it goes without saying. And aside from Reykjavik, Simon, have you thought about any other tournaments coming up, or is that just going to be like reunion one-off sort of thing? And then we'll see.
That's probably enough for a couple of years, you know. I mean, it's also time because, you know, I'm not strong enough to make money from playing. And I don't think many people are nowadays, unfortunately. So, you know, you get more responsibilities, you get older, more work-related things. And I enjoy my work, as we discussed. So playing is a bit of a luxury. I mean, I would like to – the other tournaments I like playing, the British Championships, because there's always that dream of being British chess champion. And another one in England, the Hastings competition. It's quite easy staying in England, you know. Hastings, I like as well. So, if I get the opportunity, maybe those tournaments as well.
Cool. Well, it would be fun to see you out there. Yeah, and I hope to make it abroad for a tournament sometime too. But as you say, it's not easy, especially when you got kids. Here at home. Well, Simon, we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. And then when we get back, I want to talk a bit about chess openings and some of your courses. Our friends at chessable.com are constantly dropping new courses to help you work on whatever aspect of your game you're interested in improving. In addition to Grandmaster Simon Williams' latest British Grand Prix attack, we have a new course coming from Super GM Linyar Dominguez in February, Dominate D4 with Dominguez's Semi-Tirage. It's been super trendy at the top level. It's a tough opening to crack. If you want to work on your endgame, there is Endgame Maze 2020, which is a practical workbook with modern games. And remember, whatever aspect of your game you're working on with Chessable, you can utilize space repetition to help you remember the openings, tactics, or endgame sequences that you learn from chessable.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back. So, Simon, I mean, you've become one of Chessable's most prolific authors. I was checking out your Bishop E2 course. As a Sicilian player, I'm a little worried that this is going to start showing up all over the place, and it's like yet another Sicilian sideline I'm going to have to learn to try to swat aside. But I'm curious. A, like how that project came to be, and B, what else you're working on. I'm sure as soon as one comes out, it's on to the next one for you.
Yeah, I mean that's the exciting thing about what I do. In a lot of respects, this has always been the way I've worked on chess. So even when I was playing in competitions, you know, as we discussed, trying to get the international master title, getting the grandmaster title, trying to win the British Championships, trying to win events, you have to think about the opening, and you have to. I was always one of those players who liked not just following everything that people are doing, but trying to go my own way, creating things. And with this last course, it had a bit of an interesting history. I was playing for England in the European Team Championships, and I mentioned this in the course, but I was there in a bar in Serbia with Luke McShane, Mickey Adams, Stuart Conquest, and Stephen Gordon, and we were discussing the development of the Grand Prix opening, which is a very main line against the Sicilian. And we sort of we were thinking, well, the knight on c3, it's often a bad piece, that knight, because you give away this square in the middle, and we, you know, this idea Luke suggested of playing this little bishop e2 move. I was like, yeah, this is really interesting. And also it's kind of an ideal Dutch. And this is another reason I like it. You get a great Dutch position from the pawn structure a couple of tempo up. You've got the classical attacking ideas. One thing, again, I like doing is I can't learn everything out there in chess. You know, I like having my eyes looking at different ideas, but to really understand something, I want positions with the same plans or similar plans with the same setup. It halves the kind of thing I need to learn. So by playing this idea as white, I'm effectively playing what I learned with the black pieces. So I'm saving myself a lot of time. And this came about. And obviously, I would like to say as well, as you mentioned, I've been working on these projects with Richard Palliser. And the reason for that is Richard is an international master from England, is just an incredible, incredible theoretician. He's worked with Gawain Jones, with other people. He's an incredibly hard worker. And in my eyes, he works on Chess Publishing, this great platform. He's one of the best opening guys out there. And having him, you know, been able to throw ideas about, and you must give a lot of nearly all the novelties in this course, what he's found with great computer analysis, working with him has just taken a lot of pressure off that process and made it more enjoyable. Because you don't want to ever work and feel, oh no, I've got to get up and do this, you know, which I'm sure most of us have had, especially when you're working in a call center in Brighton. But you don't really want to have that. You want to have, let's try to create something. Let's try to find something and make something better. And that's what we're trying to do now. And our next courses we're working on is this 3h4 idea against basically the King's Indian Grunfeld with d4. It's sort of a newish idea, which is again something I've been playing and experimenting with for a decade or so.
So d4, knight f6, c4, g6, and then Harry.
That's right. Then Harry. Okay. Yeah. Then Harry. Right. The thing I would like to say about these as well, these courses, you know, they're probably not, we realize it's going to sell as much as like if we did something on the Berlin or something, or like a main line. is about the right thing to say.
Apologies to Sam Shanklin,
I mean, these courses are great, but it's nice, you know, we realize they might not be abroad as much because they're sidelines, but they're really interesting, and I think they're actually probably much more useful for players than learning what everyone else is learning. Why learn what everyone else is learning when you can play something a little bit different and surprise your opponent? And also, I love these ideas myself. They're ideas that I would play and that are quite interesting, you know, very interesting. So that's why we're going for these at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at the elite level, there's definitely in my mind, a bit of a problem with how strong the engines have become and how that informs opening prep, which of course is most visible at the World Championship when it's just hard for white to find an edge, and until things crack open and Nepo goes on tilt, there's a lot of draws. Yeah. But I actually think at the club level, and Chessable of course is helping with this, there's more scope for creativity and new lines than ever, because it's kind of like, if white's given up on sort of finding a concrete edge, and if it doesn't matter for, like, you know, me, a 2100 player, whether I'm 0.5 or minus 0.2, it's going to be whoever screws up more is the one who loses. Or if no one screws up, it would be a draw, but that doesn't happen that often. So I actually feel like stuff like your Bishop E2 line and, you know, so many other sidelines, there's more room than ever for them at the, say, I don't know, below 2300 level, something like that.
I 100% agree. And you could even make a claim at every level, because look at Magnus. I mean, we mentioned him. Who was his most controversial second? It was Daniil Dubov. And if you look at Dubov's ideas, and I had a very interesting interview with him, he's known as one of the most creative and strongest chess players in the world. And he basically said, well, look, the ideas I come up with in the opening, I work with a computer, and I know that the computer will say these ideas are bad. So, but he was actually making an analogy with poker, which I'm sure you know very well. It was the expectancy of your opponent to be prepared for it. And again, I'm not really into the poker terms much, but he was playing on expectancy, that he's playing ideas that if his opponent finds 10 moves correctly in a row, he could even be worse with the white pieces, but he's expecting that, you know, his opponent won't find these perfect moves because he's surprising them first by playing a move which is not the best move. So, and this is probably why Magnus Carlsen got him. I think Magnus Carlsen got Dubov because he knew that Dubov would come up with ideas which are probably in, let's say, if they were on a discussion forum on Chessboard, people would be like, this is rubbish. The computer thinks it's bad. This is not the best move. But actually, these ideas are much more interesting and valid than the best move. They're not expected. They're very hard to refute. They can cause a lot of confusion. And, you know, with this Bishop E2, if we're going back to this opening, this is not just a trick line. You know, I think Black has a number of ways to be equal, probably like Black has in most openings, but it's more of a setup. So it's not going for tricks. You're going for particular setups which are easier for White to play. And that's another thing I think is key, picking openings which is easier for you to play the moves rather than your opponent. Because if you can naturally know what you're doing, you don't really have to think as much. Your opponent has to think to equalize. And, you know, going back to Bishop E2, that's one example. Going back to 3H4, another example, Black has to think. You're putting that hard process onto your opponent. It's a mind game after all, and you don't want them to bang out their Berlin theory for 20 moves, get equality anyway. Why would you want to do that? It makes no sense to me. But okay, I mean, you know, I do also think learning main lines is important, but it's something I'm sort of, I do, but it's not something I enjoy as much as playing sidelines, which I think are equally valid.
Yeah, and it's challenging for as Dubov alluded to, at the elite level, I mean at the club level, to be ready for your opponent's specialty when it's like some sideline. I mean, as you mentioned in Reykjavik, it's 9 games in 7 days and you get the pairings early. So there's like a fighting chance that if they're playing a narrow repertoire, you'll be ready for it. But if it's one of these US tournaments where you get the pairings 15 minutes before the round or something, like, you know, forget about it. You'll be lucky to survive. And it's interesting to hear what you said about Dubov, because in that, obviously everyone was crediting Magnus's play in the Catalan and the World Championship. Everyone was saying, oh, that's got Dubov's fingerprints all over it. But hearing you describe that sort of evaluation of the expected value of a move and the attempt to keep people off guard, there was that game in the Petrov early in the match where Magnus tried to catch him and Nepo drew like fairly easily. But then in the press conference, Magnus was just very philosophical about, like, you know, we tried to catch him. He was ready. That's how it goes. So you could definitely see the effect that mindset had on him.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, Dubov was in the team. And you mentioned the Catalan game. Obviously, that was probably the game Magnus was closest to losing, as Jan said afterwards. But before, you know, Magnus got to that position, he had his clearest winning chance as well, which we can't forget. He played one. The opening worked incredibly well for him. But having someone imaginative like Dubov alongside his rocks like Jan, Gustans, you know, Guff and Peter Heiner and these people, I think is a great combination. And, you know, if you're working from home, you know, obviously learning main lines, that's where you got your Peter Heiners, is so important. But if you can mix that up with some original ideas as well, it can work tremendously, you know, having that flexibility and just be willing to not always follow what's in front of you. But why can't I play that move? Ask yourself questions. Don't let the computer do all the answering for you. You know, that's a big mistake. You know?
Yeah. And to bring it back to the Bishop E2 against the Sicilian line, I watched your intro video and you mentioned this game of your British compatriot, Super GM Luke McShane, beating Ivan Cheparinov, who of course has been a 2700 player and top theoretician in his own right. So that sort of illustrated the point you're making. But you also mentioned that you thought that Luke, in that video, you said that you think he's one of the most talented players of all time. So I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that. Obviously, he was a top prodigy in Great Britain, but that's a strong endorsement. So I was just curious to hear what makes you think that.
Yeah, I'm probably a bit biased, you know, bound to be. I mean, I would say, you know, people I know closely, and you've been like a bit amazed at it's certainly Luke and Mickey Adams. You know, I can't not mention Mickey Adams. They're actually quite similar players, Luke and Mickey. But Luke just has this incredible understanding and incredible ideas for someone who doesn't really do chess full time. And Mickey, probably the player I'm most impressed with. I don't really understand his moves sometimes, and then he's just winning. You know, he just right. He's just like, I understand Tao's moves better, even though they're completely mental. You know, Tao goes for your king, even if it costs him a rook and a queen. But Mickey just like plays a move. He's playing like, let's say, some 2750. Plays a move and he's better, and it's like, I don't understand how he did that. So incredible, like sort of depth to the moves here playing, which you can't see on the surface. Incredible, it's like that iceberg, you know, what's below the surface. And Mickey is and Luke are both players who have that, which is so hard to see, but quite beautiful as well. Some natural talent, clearly.
Yeah. There, Mickey's got a book coming out soon, and I'm hoping to interview him because he's such a legend, and looking forward to the book, more importantly. And hearing you riff on all these great British chess players, we might as well hop into a related question from supporter of the podcast, Craig Mallon. For listeners who aren't familiar, Patreon subscribers of Perpetual Chess can find out the guests and send questions to luminaries such as the Ginger GM. So Craig asks, he says, I'm a big fan of GM Simon Williams. I especially love the infectious enthusiasm he brings to his videos. As a British expat now living in the States, my question is, how does Simon view the current state of British chess? Do you see much promising young talent in the British chess scene?
I mean, it's clearly talent. That I think goes out saying with every chess scene. I mean, youngsters in Britain, I mean there's some great players, but the state of British chess in general, I think it's pretty terrible. As in, if you look at England were in the 70s, 80s, I think they came second, third in the Olympiad, but they're one of the strongest chess nations. We were producing a lot of grandmasters, even when I was, going back 10 years. And how many grandmasters have we produced England, Britain, shall I say, in the last 10 years? Well, I can certainly name them on one hand, I would imagine, the amount of grandmasters that Britain has actually had. But if you look at other countries, they're producing a handful of grandmasters every month. Yeah. So it's like, you can just judge how chess in the nation is going. And I mean, I personally, think there's a bit of a problem with I don't know, in some tournaments and some sort of I don't know, like some people's thinking that that elite chess, they're kind of against elite chess, and like they started using these tournaments where it's called Stars Barred. So, okay, if you get to a certain grade, you can't play. And then there's been big debates on some forums, like, why are we funding the English team? Why can't we just put it into regional chess? And I've always thought this is completely crazy. And it's normally by people who don't play a lot of chess, but they're making big, big things about this. And I think you need to support the people at the top, because you need to give juniors who are coming through something to aspire to. I mean, I know when I was playing, I'd look at the grandmasters, like, I really want to be one of these guys. I love chess. They're going around playing tournaments. And if you're not supporting the players at the top by, funding there to represent England in the Olympiad, by giving them good money and stuff like this, why would anyone want to become a grandmaster? It doesn't make any sense. So I think there's a lot of problems. I mean, I know there's some great things going on in British chess. I mean, and a lot of changes happen all the time. There's some, are some great individuals, but I think actually it's probably people away from the federation in general, which are doing the big changes. Like Malcolm Payne has been great for chess, but he hasn't really got anything to do with the federation, just because he's done the London Classic. He's done tangible things that you can see. And I know, again, I don't mean this about everyone in the British Chess Federation. That's just not the way it is. There's some great people there, but I just don't see really the development with younger players over the last 10 years. And there's too much stupid politics about why we, this thing about, let's not fund the top players. I want people to play, a group of 80-year-olds to play down at the town hall for the next 5 years instead, stuff like this. But Anyway, bit of a rant there, really. Don't know where that came from.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's I get what you're saying. It's disappointing. There's so many British chess legends, I mean, in the contemporary scene. But yeah, the pipeline, I mean, doesn't at least from the outside looking in, doesn't seem as strong.
It doesn't look good. I mean, like, you know, all the older chess players are going to die off. You know, that's what happens in life. And do we have a lot of younger players coming through? Grandmasters. Well, we have some great talent. Like we have Ravi Harrier, we've got Marcus Harley, but I think all of these guys, they've become where they are because of the help from their parents and their own hard work rather than the Federation's hard work in general. So it's like, you know, we really need to try to get on top of this, and we're going to lose this chess we have in England, I feel.
Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, we talked about this in our first interview 5 years ago, and it sounds like even though the chess world as a whole is thriving, things haven't changed that much. And I know here in the U.S. it's true as well. I mean, the U.S. Chess Federation is a nonprofit, so resources are always going to be, I don't know if scarce is the right word, but there's always going to be more noble things you can fund than there is money. So it's always an issue, but I certainly agree with what you said about, like, you need to support the top players, in order for, the up and comers to have something to aspire to.
I just think it tickles down, you know, if you support the players who have worked all their life and achieved the things that every single player would like to achieve. If you support those guys, it's going to just tickle down through every layer of chess. And I think that's so important to keep doing.
Yeah, and yeah. I do feel like that's happening on a global scale with, like, part of the reason the, like, young players are getting better and better is because they see, you know, obviously we wish it were that if you make it to the top 100, you can make, you know, 6 to 7 figures, but more realistically it's the top 10. But at least they see, okay, if I become elite at this, like, I'm going to be very, very well rewarded for my services. But that's on a global scale. It helps more if it's on a local scale, and that's where if it's 100 instead of 10, there's, you know, a couple, like, well-paid, respected professionals in every country at minimum. Anyway, one more sort of Great Britain related listener question. This one is from Jonathan Slater, although it's only tangentially Great Britain related. He says, can Simon tell us about the Mind Sports Center in London? He said he saw you attempting to teach Alexandra Botez how to drink a flaming Sambuca on YouTube there.
That was at Battersea Chess Club, actually. But there's two, a couple of great places in London. There's the Battersea Chess Club, which has a really nice chess club where I played Alexander Botez. Great, great fun. The flaming Sambuca was there. she claimed she'd never done it before, but I'm not sure I believe her. Huh. I'm not sure what happened. That night went a bit off track, shall we say, around that moment. But it was a lot of fun. Very nice person. It was lovely meeting her there. But then, like you say, you have this Mind Sports Centre now, which is just been taken over by I think it's Hammersmith Chess Club, and this is a great center in London, which is quite a big place. They have a bar there, which is always nice, a bit of social things, but it also does other things. It does other games. They have a bridge night, they have this kind of thing, but they're trying to build it so they can hopefully have more, should we say, Grandmaster Norm tournaments there, events going on there, and just somewhere you can always go and play a bit of chess. And it's quite phenomenal to have anything like that. So well done to them. Yeah.
That's great. And that's the sort of thing we're talking about. That could be huge for the next generation. Cool. All right. Well, we're going to take one more break, Simon. And then when we get back, we got a couple more questions to get to. So we will be right back. Listeners, our friends at aimchess.com have a fun new feature that I want to tell you about. It is called the Aim Chess Recap. If you're familiar with Spotify Wrapped, it's basically the chess version of that, your chess year in review. They have a new design to make the user experience more fun, and they tell you all kinds of stats from your year, the ones you might be used to, like how you do with certain openings, certain colors, against who you played the most, how many minutes you played the total year, and then some fun stuff like the total amount of smothered mates you played, the number of en passants taken, all of your missed mate and ones. Okay, maybe that one's not as fun. And if you see something you want to share, you can easily share it on social media. So that's called the Aim Chess Recap. Link is in the show description. It's free to check out. And then if you do decide to subscribe to Aim Chess, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. All right, let's head back to Perpetual Chess.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
And we are back. And Simon, so we've got a couple sort of stray topics I want to hit that we haven't come to yet. I've greatly enjoyed this conversation, of course. One of which, of course, is your new venture, G-Chess, which you were nice enough to give me the keys to take a tour around. I had checked it out even prior to that, but I've been really enjoying it. But we did have a couple questions along the lines, one from the aforementioned Jonathan Slater, who said he's interested in G-Chess, but he doesn't understand it. So he got the sense it could be a powerful tool, but he doesn't completely understand it. And we had a similar question from Jerry Snitzelar that we'll get to in a question. But first of all, could you just talk about like how G-Chess was created and what sort of the vision for it is?
Yeah, certainly. I suppose around a year ago now, the business that I run, Ginger GM, joined the Play Magnus Group.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Really exciting to have this opportunity, which again, if you go back to Reykjavik, you never imagine these things happening. You know? It's like, what the hell's going on? But that was great. And you know, about a year before we did join, I just had some ideas about some things which I would like to use, which I think would be very useful for other people to use. You know, obviously we had Ginger GM, but I wanted to create. Well, it was actually, I mean, nearly every idea I've had, Ben, has come from a conversation down a pub, which is brilliant. And I think my friend was joking to me about 10 years ago saying, you've got to make, you know, like chess base is fantastic. You've got to make a ginger base just for a laugh. And we did actually buy gingerbase.com at some point and just thought, yeah, okay, just for a laugh. I don't know why, probably drunk. But then it was funny. But then it was like, okay, well, chess base is phenomenal. I have to say, I use it in tournaments, but the feedback that I've got and that I've sometimes found, it's a bit overcomplicated in the uses of it. And at elite level, it's indispensable. You need it if you're a grandmaster, international master. But if you're a 1500 and you want to get very quick access to vast information on a position, then you don't want to click, click, click. You want something immediate that you can use and that you don't have to download a great amount. You know, you can just switch on your phone, bang, you get that information. It's like, right, okay. So it's like have an idea of trying to make some simplified database of, you could even say the Googler chess was an idea. Like, you know, you put a position on a board on your phone and it gives you access to nearly every bit of information you can get on that position. And not just computer analysis. And, you know, computer analysis is important, but people are going the wrong way by just concentrating on what the computer says. I want to see what a grandmaster, an expert in this position says about it, what he's written, what video, what he's talking about. So that was kind of the idea, to try to make a Google of chess, an encyclopedia of chess, have a, you know, so you can put any position on the board and you get great information on that. And you get it from various sources. So that was one idea. And that's how we started coming about with G-Chess, just trying to make it that possibility. Position on the board, you can find stuff in chess publishing. You can find stuff if Magnus Carlsen's played that position. You can find videos on YouTube with our intelligent search on that position. You can find Ginger GM videos. This is also important. It's like how many people have brought videos in their lifetime, like from Ginger GM. And let's say iChess, any video company, they've watched the video on their favorite opening. Let's say, I don't know, I'll just put any opening. And then they play a game, even a blitz game, And they're like, hang on a minute, I did something wrong there. What did I do wrong? I can't remember that video. I do it all the time. Right. And we wanted to create something that fixed that problem. So then it kind of developed into this next thing of, we wanted to be able to use your Blitz games, which we can do now on leadchess.com, and reference it with these videos as well as everything else. So when you play a move that has gone away from our suggestion in the video, you will go to that time clip in the video and it will say, okay, you've played this mistake in your Blitz game. In the video, here's Simon explaining what you should have played. And you go exactly to that thing. We didn't want to make it overcomplicated. It's like you played a game on Lee Chess on move 9. You've played this move, which wasn't what was recommended in the Ginger Gem video. Here's a recommendation precisely at that point. So we've created that now as well. So you can reference. So if you've got the Ginger Gem collection, you can play chess and have immediate access to how good were you at memorizing those lines. And we're doing that with all these other resources as well. And I would like to say, you know, it's been a bit of a journey. We haven't really had, you know, much funding. We did it before, but we have now. We've got a bit more help from Play Magnus. And it's been a sort of adventure where we've made mistakes, no doubt. We want feedback. When we first opened, it was maybe, I'll be honest, a little bit early in hindsight. But we're very open to listening to all ideas, how we can improve. And it's an ongoing process. We're now very happy with what we got. Feel it's incredibly powerful and very useful. But we're always trying to improve things. And we're bringing some big changes about to make it simpler for users. And that's one thing we kind of forgot, I'll be honest. It's like when we first did it, we had all these great ideas. It's like, oh, yeah, that'd be so cool if we could do this, do that. And we kind of did them all. What we forgot, it's got to be simple for the user. So we're going back to keeping those resources, but trying to keep it simple. And I suppose, Ben, the two things it's trying to achieve is like that database Google of positions. So you've got unlimited resources to any position, loads of different things to look at, and that way that you can improve from your Blitz games even, which is kind of unheard of. How do you improve from Blitz? Well, you can do it by using GChess now. So that was our idea, I suppose, for how it's come about and a little bit about the development of it.
Yeah, it's definitely cool that you can import your Blitz games and have them on the cloud. And as I mentioned, the one I've seen people praise the most on Twitter and that I find super fun is the ability to search any position so that if there's some opening, as Simon says, that you're like, man, I just don't understand the ideas in this position. You can search to see if that position, like on move 10 or whatever it may be, has been discussed on YouTube, and you guys are incorporating it with Chessable Short and Sweet courses, which of course are free as well. So definitely I'm looking forward to what else develops from it, but I'm enjoyed checking it out. And on the topic of suggestions, we have another listener question from Jerry Snitzelar. Thanks for supporting the pod, Jerry. And Jerry asks, he says, GChess looks like a wonderful site from what I've seen with many features. Recently on Twitter, someone had an opening line and was wondering if there were books covering it. That had me thinking, I know GChess can point people to videos and courses containing lines, but does it have the capability to point people to books as well? Seems like it would be a nice feature if it isn't implemented, but I can also see it being a potentially difficult task if there isn't an electronic version of the book already.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've basically thought about nearly everything chess, how we could get every single bit of chess material in the world relate, you know, a link on GChess. We've tried to think about this, and you know, we've certainly thought about it with electronic books. I mean, at the moment, you know, what you've got, you put a position on a board or a position for your Blitz game, and you can link that to chess publishing. So that's 30,000 annotated games by IMs or GMs. And the reason I really like that is because that's what I use when I'm playing international competitions. I use chess publishing, their material, because it's updated every month. So you can do that. New in chess, the yearbooks, which again are only annotated by the world's best players, and they explain their ideas. You can do that with the positions. YouTube, so it's an intelligent search. It will find positions in YouTube, and we're increasing that every day. By your favorite author, the Ginger GM library, you get online games, so the top players who played online, offline games. And again, you come to books. We'd love to do that. We'd love to have the opportunity to search books. I mean, it'd be easier for us if it was electronic books and you could get a link straight away to the information. You know, I think that'd be cool because we want to be able to provide that information when you search a position so you can get results rather than being told, oh, you can find this in, you know, this book that you can get from this library, which might also be okay, but we want to show you that information kind of immediately when you do the search. So any suggestions, we're open to them. I mean, we've got the Chessable short and sweets as well. We want to get Chessable courses in there at some point. We want everything to be there, like I say, like the Google of chess, but easy to use. But I definitely love to hear everyone's feedback, because it is, as I say, ongoing, and we just want to make it as good as we can. And we want it to be something that people enjoy using and helps their chess. You know, that's also key.
Yeah. Well, it is. I do like the interface. So yeah, and certainly, like, if it were incorporated with the Chessable courses that one owns, that would be awesome. And to Jerry's question, I'm guessing there's probably some intellectual property issues in terms of, like, if you just had it linked to any book. Obviously, G-Chess under the Play Magnus umbrella. So if nothing else, maybe New in Chess Books and Everyman Chess Books someday could be included. And then
we already link it to, like, say, the New in Chess yearbooks. So, you know, any position will link to one of their 150 yearbook positions. So if you think before G-Chess came along, you had 150 yearbooks, you know, just sitting on your shelf. If you wanted to find a certain opening, you'd have to go to the contents page of each of those books and then look for that position. It would take you hours. On G-Chess, you can do it now in a second, because the position on the board, it will find the article. So we could do it. I mean, Everyman is also part of the Play Magnus group. So we'd like to obviously do it with Everyman. Maybe that'd be the logical next step. But it is, of course, there is a problem of intellectual property. We can't just start putting up books we don't own. We've got to have some deal with them. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be possible. But we're working on all these things. Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully it's early days. So definitely look forward to continued improvements. And on the topic of openings, we have one more question, Simon, one more listener question, which is from Jonathan Evans. He said he loves your Grandmaster Gambit's Chessable course. He's been playing the Elephant Gambit for a number of years with pretty good results. It seems to work pretty well in Blitz and Bullet. What are your thoughts about this opening? And he also wants to know what you think of the Papa Tukulat opening, which is Gambit, which I wasn't familiar with, but it goes up. E4, E6, B3, D5, and then white goes Bishop B2, leaving the e-pawn hanging.
Okay.
Not hanging, I guess.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, first of all, the Elephant Gambit, I can sort of recall quite a funny, well, not funny story, but a story. I mean, it was, I don't know, it was the British Championships probably about 10 years ago. And I was with an ex-girlfriend there. And I got basically, in the last round, I was doing very well. So we got to round 11 and I was playing David Howell. Who some people might know.
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty handy, and he was pretty handy about 10 years ago as well. He was the top seed, and he was half a point ahead of me with the white pieces. So I needed to win with black to win the British Championships. And it was on, like, board one, big, big game. And, you know, I did a bit of prep in the morning, but I had a major row with the ex-girlfriend. A massive row. And it was like, I just couldn't be asked. I just sort of turned the computer off, got some fresh air, walked to the game, just straight into the game. And I was like, oh God, what am I going to play now? And I was still a bit angry. So I wheeled out the Elephant Gambit. So it went E4, E5, probably the most important game of my life, knight F3. And I just went D5. Not knowing anything about it at all, just that it was called the Elephant Gambit, wheeled it out against the top seed in the most important game of my life. Very interesting game. Nearly had him, but he calculated well and beat me. And after that, I've never played it since. I think it's one of those gambits which I like playing gambits, don't get me wrong. And if you're going to play something like that, which is, at the essence, unsound. I mean, there's a difference between that kind of gambit and some of the ideas I was suggesting earlier, which even if your opponent plays perfectly, you're not going to have a lost position. You might be a little bit worse, but okay, you're not going to be lost. I think the problem with the Elephant Gambit, if your opponent plays perfectly, you're going to have a lost position. You're a pawn down. So you're gambling. You are gambling. And in the long run, it's like, you know, do people who don't know anything and go down to the casino, do they make money? No, they don't. They lose because they're gambling. And you're doing the same thing. You're becoming one of those kind of mugs. And I dare I say it. So it's great fun to play occasionally or to gamble for a bit of a buzz like you do down the casino. But having it as a long-term opening probably not the best idea.
Yeah, well, it also depends on your level. I mean, I think if you're like...
Of course, yeah, of course. If maybe you're like, yeah, yeah.
If you're like 14, 1500 even, I think up to around there, like it's probably... You have an elevated chance of catching your opponent off guard, and it's probably not going to cost you the game. And especially as he mentioned in Blitz and Bullet. But I got a couple follow-ups on this story, Simon.
Okay.
So number one, okay. The argument with your girlfriend. You couldn't hold it off for 24 hours. You have the most important game of your life.
Clearly not, Ben. No, I can't remember what it's about. It's probably about something completely mean or, you know, it's like
right.
Nothing important, but
just yeah. Escalates and you dig in and yeah suddenly you're playing the Elephant Gambit the next day.
That's right. Great fun. The same day.
Yeah. And then I'm also, I mean, you wouldn't be able to speak to this better than I am, than I could. I mean, I really enjoyed when I got to interview David Howell and a big fan of his, but I always think of him as an English player. I didn't know he dabbled in E4 much at all. So was he playing a lot of E4 in those days, and how surprised were you?
I think whenever he's played me, he's always played E4, and I played him with the black pieces like 6 or 7 times. And okay. he was very clever with his preparation. He didn't want to play against my Dutch. He probably realized that I understood the Dutch a lot better than him. I knew the positions. Even if he could maybe get an opening advantage, my understanding of the middle game, I don't think he wanted to do. But he also knew that I would often play the Sicilian. He'd play the C3 Sicilian. And he knew by doing that, he'd get me into a position that I felt uncomfortable in. Because when I played the Sicilian, I wanted a dynamic game. And he would take it into positions he liked playing. So he was very clever with his opening choice against me, I feel, by playing E4. Also, I remember the question about B3 against the French, and I better just answer that.
Papatico or whatever it's called.
I had no idea. That sounds like a James Bond villain or something.
Yeah, it really does.
But I had no idea it was called that. But yeah, I think that's a totally sound opening. Very interesting. I don't know if Black should even take the pawn on E4, but very playable. And also, Ben, you did mention that, you know, for lower rated players playing these openings, I was being a bit harsh, and totally enjoy yourself, play gambits. But at some point, if you're going to get better and better, these gambits will stop working, and don't try to make them work. Then it's time to give them up. That's probably the way to do it, you know?
Yeah, so, that's great advice. Yeah, I always say, like, listen to the feedback you're getting from your game. So if you're starting to, yeah, I mean, if it's not working, don't play it. But if it is working, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So I'm, you know, I could keep you forever, Simon, but realistically, I only have a couple more questions, one of which brings it back to what you were, to the aforementioned David Howell. Of course, I, like many chess citizens of the internet, greatly enjoyed the video, the stream that Magnus did recently of playing the Lee Chess Bullet Tournament, where he and David and a few others were drinking and listening to music and enjoying themselves. And I'm curious, I know that that was in Norway and you don't live in Norway, but I'm curious if you've had any similar experiences that were not streamed.
Well, probably, Ben, even with you.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, actually thinking about it.
That's not as exciting, though.
I mean, do you literally mean like where I've been...
No, well, like drinking with Magnus. Let's start with that.
Drinking with Magnus. Yeah, I mean, I know it's a very friendly. The chess world's a very friendly place in general because everyone, you know, you fight someone in the day at the board, but you get quite stressed out and you want to relieve that pressure. And you know, most of the top players know each other, and even, you know, I know a lot of the top players. So with Magnus, yeah, I've shared beers with him, played Blitz with him a fair few times. He crushed me, of course, but he's a very nice guy. I mean, really nice guy. As you know, to actually find people that are not nice is a lot harder in the chess world because you're sharing this love, and why you don't need to be an arsehole. You know, you can just enjoy it. You don't need to be. So it's a really good environment, chess. And like I say, yeah, I've played Magnus, had some stories with him, and yeah. You know,
sounds like you don't want to share the stories, though.
No, they're all good. They're all good. I don't know him that well. I don't know him as well as David. You know, I sort of know him a bit, but not hardly as well as David.
Yeah, and you've known him since you were a little kid. You mentioned in one of your videos showing him an opening when he was a kid that he now plays. It was some dodgy gambit, as I recall.
I met Magnus when he was quite young. It was you know,
the Carol, maybe the
it was the hillbilly attack.
Yeah, that's
the one. So yeah. I was playing in Oslo, and I was probably about 18 years old, and there was a young Magnus Carlsen watching me play Blitz, and I think he probably asked me, you know, he was very, very young. He asked me, what's that then? And it's like the Hillbilly. and then I played him in Gausdal in Norway once as well. And I played him in a Blitz event in Reykjavik as well. The same year we were there, I played him. I think he played there in 2006.
Yeah, he was there, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I played him in the Blitz event afterwards. So I sort of come across him a bit, not so much anymore. He's flown above me, but he was always nice. He was always a very dedicated, clever, and nice guy. But yeah, you know, nice. I don't know him as well as some of the other
players. Okay. Yeah, and the Hillbilly is E4 C6 D4 D5 or no E4 C6 no. Bishop C4 D5
right.
Bishop B3.
That's yeah. right. Yeah,
legendary name for an opening. It's amazing. and the last topic tangentially related to what we're discussing, Simon, is the famed Goodnight Pub in Oslo, a chess themed pub. Now, you've mentioned it a few times on Twitter over the years. Are you a partner in the Goodnight or just a fan?
Yeah, I've got some small shares in it, and it's, well, quite a funny story again that I was playing in the under. It's always these under 21 world championships, but I was playing in Armenia, and this is obviously like over 20 years ago now, and a Norwegian chap came up to me there. Not Magnus, my friend Torbjørn Hansen. And he said he invited me for a drink. And we maybe drunk a little bit too much at this World Championships, not the most professional approach. And I think we were singing The Doors, walking down some road. And he always said, and I always said, obviously when you're drunk, yeah, one day we will get a pub. And when we get a pub, we'll run a pub, you know, as you do when you're young and you're drunk. You know, it's like, yeah, getting a pub, such a great idea. So about 20 years later, he gave me an email and he said, Simon, I've got a pub. You still interested? And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, why not?
That's great.
So it's like, yeah. And literally 20 years later, he said, yeah, I've actually just got involved with this chess pub in Norway. We're looking for people to buy some very small shares in it. Very small shares to help, you know, support it. And it's like, sounded like a great idea. And so that's how it started. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. It looks like so much fun whenever I see pictures and stuff. And is the business going okay? I mean, if a chess pub is going to succeed anywhere, it has to be in Oslo, I would think.
Yeah. It's an amazing place. Obviously COVID has hit hospitality quite bad, as in, you know, when I was over there last time, they had the Omicron or, you know, virus or sort of hit bad in Norway, and they had to close everything down for a month. But in general, it's doing great, and it's always very busy and really, really nice place to be as well. That's more, you know, that's also important. It's just somewhere I really want to go, and I think any chess lover would want to go as well. Lovely, you know, highly recommended, even if I didn't have any interest.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see a chess pub in every major city someday.
Oh, definitely.
That's got to be the goal. Yeah, and definitely. And in Reykjavik, there was, I don't know if it would be officially called a chess pub, but there was a certain pub that a lot of people went to for postmortems. The name escapes me, but I'm curious if you know, is that still going?
I don't think it is. No, I think that place is not going anymore.
Oh, bummer.
There were even talks about a good night in Reykjavik, but we'll have to see how that goes.
Yeah, that would be the next logical place, I feel like.
It certainly would be, yeah. I mean, Reykjavik, of course, quite famously has the most amount of grandmasters per head compared to any nationality in the world. So it's another chess-loving nation, or at least it used to. I think it still has, but but it's a chess-loving nation. So I think anything chess-related there, obviously Bobby Fischer's ended up there. His grave is there. There's, you know, there's that bookshop where he used to sit, which is, there's loads of history of chess there. So it kind of needs a chess pub, I think, Reykjavik.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, next time we chat, Simon, maybe, you know, 3-5 years down the road, hopefully there'll be some progress on this front.
Hopefully.
All right. Well, Simon, this has been great as expected. Always entertaining to talk to you. Are there any topics you wanted to hit that we haven't discussed yet?
No. I'd like to thank you, Ben. Thank you very much. And obviously thank all the listeners. I mean, everyone's help buying my courses is greatly appreciated. It allows me to do more of the free YouTube videos, the free streams. But, you know, it's what keeps me going, what I survive on. You guys enjoying the courses, learning from the courses, and paying me back as well for that. So thank you so much to everyone. And if you haven't brought my course, that's also okay. Just about,
you're forgiven. Right? Yeah.
You're forgiven. Awesome.
Okay. And obviously is Twitter the best place to follow you, Simon, along with Twitch and YouTube?
Yeah. You can follow me on Twitter. That's what I use the most. So.
Okay. Excellent. And obviously Chessable and GChess as well. All right, Simon. Well, it's been fun, and we will catch you next time. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Social Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.